The Secret Adversary, Agatha Christie, Chapter 8, The Adventures of Tommy. Taken aback, though he was, by the man's words, Tommy didn't hesitate. If audacity had successfully carried him so far, it was to be hoped it would carry him yet farther. He quietly passed into the house and mounted the ramshackle staircase. Everything in the house was filthy beyond words. The grimy paper, of a pattern now indistinguishable, hung in loose festoons from the wall. In every angle was a gray mass of cobweb. Tommy proceeded leisurely. By the time he reached the bend of the staircase, he'd heard the man below disappear into a back room. Clearly, no suspicion attached to him as yet. To come to the house and ask for Mr. Brown appeared indeed to be a reasonable and natural proceeding. At the top of the stairs, Tommy halted to consider his next move. In front of him ran a narrow passage with doors opening on either side of it. From the one nearest him on the left came a low murmur of voices. It was this room which he'd been directed to enter. But what held his glance fascinated was a small recess immediately on his right, half concealed by a torn velvet curtain. It was directly opposite the left-handed door, and, owing to its angle, it also commanded a good view of the upper part of the staircase. As a hiding place for one, or at a pinch, two men, it was ideal, being about 2 feet deep and 3 feet wide. It attracted Tommy mightily. He thought things over in his usual slow and steady way, deciding that the mention of Mr. Brown was not a request for an individual, but in all probability a password used by the gang. His lucky use of it had gained him admission. So far, he'd aroused no suspicion, but he must decide quickly on his next step. Suppose he were boldly to enter the room on the left of the passage. Would the mere fact of his having been admitted to the house be sufficient? Perhaps a further password would be required, or at any rate, some proof of identity. The doorkeeper clearly didn't know all the members of the gang by sight, but it might be different upstairs. On the whole, it seemed to him that luck had served him very well so far, but that there was such a thing as trusting it too far. To enter that room was a colossal risk. He couldn't hope to sustain his part indefinitely. Sooner or later, he was almost bound to betray himself, and then he would have thrown away a vital chance in mere foolhardiness. A repetition of the signal knock sounded on the door below, and Tommy, his mind made up, slipped quickly into the recess and cautiously drew the curtain farther across so that it shielded him completely from sight. There were several rents and slits in the ancient material which afforded him a good view. He would watch events, and any time he chose, could, after all, join the assembly, modeling his behavior on that of the new arrival. The man who came up the staircase with a furtive, soft-footed tread was quite unknown to Tommy. He was obviously of the very dregs of society. The low, beetling brows and the criminal jaw, the bestiality of the whole countenance, were new to the young man, though he was the type that Scotland Yard would have recognized at a glance. The man passed the recess, breathing heavily as he went. He stopped at the door opposite and gave a repetition of the signal knock. A voice inside called out something, and the man opened the door and passed in, affording Tommy a momentary glimpse of the room inside. He thought there must be about 4 or 5 people seated around a long table that took up most of the space, but his attention was caught and held by a tall man with close-cropped hair and a short, pointed, navel-looking beard who sat at the head of the table with papers in front of him. As the newcomer entered, he glanced up, and with a correct but curiously precise enunciation which attracted Tommy's notice, he asked, "Your number, comrade?"
14, Governor,"
replied the other hoarsely. Correct. The door shut again. If that isn't a Hun, I'm a Dutchman, said Tommy to himself. And running the show darn systematically, too, as they always do. Lucky I didn't roll in, I'd have given the wrong number, and there would have been the deuce to pay. No, this is the place for me. Hello, there's another knock. This visitor proved to be of an entirely different type to the last. Tommy recognized in him an Irish Sinn Féiner. Certainly, Mr. Brown's organization was a far-reaching concern. The common criminal, the well-bred Irish gentleman, the pale Russian, and the efficient German master of the ceremonies. Truly a strange and sinister gathering. Who was this man who held in his finger these curiously variegated links of an unknown chain? In this case, the procedure was exactly the same. The signal knock, the demand for a number, and the reply. Correct. Two knocks followed in quick succession on the door below. The first man was quite unknown to Tommy, who put him down as a city clerk. A quiet, intelligent-looking man, rather shabbily dressed. The second was of the working classes, and his face was vaguely familiar to the young man. 3 minutes later came another, a man of commanding appearance, exquisitely dressed, and evidently well-born. His face, again, was not unknown to the watcher, though he could not for the moment put a name to it. After his arrival, there was a long wait. In fact, Tommy concluded that the gathering was now complete and was just cautiously creeping out from his hiding place when another knock sent him scuttling back to cover. This last comer came up the stairs so quietly that he was almost abreast of Tommy before the young man had realized his presence. He was a small man, very pale, with a gentle, almost womanish air. The angle of the cheekbones hinted at his Slavonic ancestry. Otherwise, there was nothing to indicate his nationality. As he passed the recess, he turned his head slowly. The strange, light eyes seemed to burn through the curtain. Tommy could hardly believe that the man didn't know he was there, and in spite of himself, he shivered. He was no more fanciful than the majority of young Englishmen, but he could not rid himself of the impression that some unusually potent force emanated from the man. The creature reminded him of a venomous snake. A moment later, his impression was proved correct. The newcomer knocked on the door as all had done, but his reception was very different. The bearded man rose to his feet, and all the others followed suit. The German came forward and shook hands. His heels clicked together. "We are honored," he said. "We are greatly honored. I much feared that it would be impossible." The other answered in a low voice that had a kind of hiss in it. "There were difficulties. It will not be possible again, I fear. But one meeting is essential to define my policy. I can do nothing without Mr. Brown. He is here." The change in the German's voice was audible as he replied with slight hesitation. "We have received a message. It is impossible for him to be present in person." He stopped, giving a curious impression of having left the sentence unfinished. A very slow smile overspread the face of the other. He looked round at a circle of uneasy faces. "Ah, I understand. I have read of his methods. He works in the dark and trusts no one. But all the same, it is possible that he is among us now." He looked round him again, and again that expression of fear swept over the group. Each man seemed eyeing his neighbor doubtfully. The Russian tapped his cheek. "So be it. Let us proceed." The German seemed to pull himself together. He indicated the place he'd been occupying at the head of the table. The Russian demurred, but the other insisted. "It is the only possible place," he said, "for number 1. Perhaps number 14 will shut the door." In another moment, Tommy was once more confronting bare wooden panels, and the voices within had sunk once more to a mere indistinguishable murmur. Tommy became restive. The conversation he had overheard had stimulated his curiosity. He felt that, by hook or by crook, he must hear more. There was no sound from below, and it didn't seem likely that the doorkeeper would come upstairs. After listening intently for a minute or two, he put his head round the curtain. The passage was deserted. Tommy bent down and removed his shoes. Then, leaving them behind the curtain, he walked gingerly out on his stocking feet, and kneeling down by the closed door, he laid his ear cautiously to the crack. To his intense annoyance, he could distinguish little more. Just a chance word here and there, if a voice was raised, which merely served to whet his curiosity still farther. He eyed the handle of the door tentatively. Could he turn it by degrees so gently and imperceptibly that those in the room would notice nothing? He decided that with great care it could be done. Very slowly, a fraction of an inch at a time, he moved it round, holding his breath in his excessive care. A little more still. Would it never be finished? Ah, at last, it would turn no farther. He stayed so for a minute or two, then drew a deep breath and pressed it ever so slightly inward. The door did not budge. Tommy was annoyed. If he had to use too much force, it would almost certainly creak. He waited until the voices rose a little, then he tried again. Still, nothing happened. He increased the pressure. Had the beastly thing stuck? Finally, in desperation, he pushed with all his might, but the door remained firm. And at last the truth dawned on him. It was locked or bolted on the inside. For a moment or two, Tommy's indignation got the better of him. "Well, I'm damned," he said. "What a dirty trick." As his indignation cooled, he prepared to face the situation. Clearly, the first thing to be done was to restore the handle to its original position. If he let it go suddenly, the men inside would be almost certain to notice it. So, with the same infinite pains, he reversed his former tactics. All went well, and with a sigh of relief, the young man rose to his feet. There was a certain bulldog tenacity about Tommy that made him slow to admit defeat. Checkmated for the moment, he was far from abandoning the conflict. He still intended to hear what was going on in the locked room. As one plan failed, he must hunt about for another. He looked round him. A little farther along the passage on the left was a second door. He slipped silently along to it. He listened for a moment or two, then tried the handle. It yielded, and he slipped inside. The room, which was untenanted, was furnished as a bedroom. Like everything else in the house, the furniture was falling to pieces, and the dirt was, if anything, more abundant. But what interested Tommy was the thing he had hoped to find, a communicating door between the two rooms, up on the left by the window. Carefully closing the door into the passage behind him, he stepped across to the other and examined it closely. The bolt was shot across it. It was very rusty and had clearly not been used for some time. By gently wriggling it to and fro, Tommy managed to draw it back without making too much noise. Then he repeated his former maneuvers with the handle, this time with complete success. The door swung open. A crack, a mere fraction, but enough for Tommy to hear what went on. There was a velvet portiere on the inside of this door, which prevented him from seeing, but he was able to recognize the voices with a reasonable amount of accuracy. The Sinn Feiner was speaking. His rich Irish voice was unmistakable. "That's all very well, but more money is essential. No money, no results." Another voice, which Tommy rather thought was that of Boris, replied, "Will you guarantee that there are results? In a month from now, sooner or later as you wish, I will guarantee you such a reign of terror in Ireland as shall shake the British Empire to its foundations." There was a pause, and then came the soft, sibilant accents of Number One.
"Good. You shall have the money. Boris, you will see to that."
Boris asked a question. "Via the Irish Americans and Mr. Potter, as usual?" "I guess that'll be all right," said a new voice with a transatlantic intonation. "Though I'd like to point out, here and now, that things are getting a mite difficult. There's not the sympathy there was, and a growing disposition to let the Irish settle their own affairs without interference from America." Tommy felt that Boris had shrugged his shoulders as he answered, "Does that matter, since the money only nominally comes from the States?" "The chief difficulty is the landing of the ammunition," said the Sinn Féiner. "The money is conveyed in easily enough, thanks to our colleague here." Another voice, which Tommy fancied was that of the tall, commanding-looking man whose face had seemed familiar to him, said, "Think of the feelings of Belfast if they could hear you." "That is settled, then," said the sibilant tones. "Now, in the matter of the loan to an English newspaper, you have arranged the details satisfactorily, Boris?"
"I think so."
"That is good. An official denial from Moscow will be forthcoming if necessary."
There was a pause, and then the clear voice of the German broke the silence. "I'm directed by Mr. Brown to place the summaries of the reports from the different unions before you. That of the miners is most satisfactory. We must hold back the railways. There may be trouble with the ASE. For a long time there was a silence, broken only by the rustle of papers and an occasional word of explanation from the German. Then Tommy heard the light tap-tap of fingers drumming on the table.
"And the date, my dear friend?" said Number One.
"The 29th.
The Russian seemed to consider.
"That is rather soon."
"I know. But it was settled by the principal labor leaders, and we cannot seem to interfere too much. They must believe it to be entirely their own show."
The Russian laughed softly, as though amused.
"Yes, yes," he said, "that is true. They must have no inkling that we are using them for our own ends. They're honest men, and that is their value to us. It's curious, but you cannot make a revolution without honest men. The instinct of the population is infallible." He paused and then repeated, as though the phrase pleased him, "Every revolution has had its honest men. They are soon disposed of afterwards." There was a sinister note in his voice. The German resumed. "Climes must go. He's too far-seeing. Number 14 will see to that." There was a hoarse murmur. "That's all right, Governor." And then after a moment or two, "Suppose I'm nabbed?"
"You will have the best legal talent to defend you," replied the German quietly. "But in any case, you will wear gloves fitted with the fingerprints of a notorious housebreaker. You have little to fear."
"Oh, I ain't afraid, Governor. All for the good of the cause. The streets is going to run with blood, so they say."
He spoke with a grim relish. "Dreams of it, sometimes I does. And diamonds and pearls rolling round in the gutter for anyone to pick up." Tommy heard a chair shifted. Then Number One spoke.
"Then, all is arranged. We are assured of success."
"I think so," but the German spoke with less than his usual confidence.
Number One's voice held suddenly a dangerous quality.
"What has gone wrong?"
"Nothing, but..."
"But what?"
"The labor leaders. Without them, as you say, we can do nothing. If they do not declare a general strike on the 29th, why should they not? As you've said, they're honest. And in spite of everything we've done to discredit the government in their eyes, I'm not sure that they haven't got a sneaking faith and belief in it. But I know they abuse it unceasingly. But on the whole, public opinion swings to the side of the government. They will not go against it. Again, the Russian's fingers drummed on the table. To the point, my friend. I was given to understand that there was a certain document in existence which assured success. That is so. If that document were placed before the leaders, the result would be immediate. They would publish it, broadcast throughout England, and declare for the revolution without a moment's hesitation. The government would be broken, finally and completely. Then what more do you want? The document itself, said the German bluntly. Ah, it is not in your possession? But you know where it is. No. Does anyone know where it is? One person, perhaps. And we're not sure of that, even. Who is this person? A girl. Tommy held his breath. A girl? The Russian's voice rose contemptuously. And you have not made her speak? In Russia, we have ways of making a girl talk. This case is different, said the German sullenly. How different? He paused a moment, then went on. Where's the girl now? The girl? Yes. She is... But Tommy heard no more. A crashing blow descended on his head, and all was darkness. Chapter 9. Tuppence enters domestic service. When Tommy set forth on the trail of the two men, it took all Tuppence's self-command to refrain from accompanying him. However, she contained herself as best she might, consoled by the reflection that her reasoning had been justified by events. The two men had undoubtedly come from the second-floor flat, and that one slender thread of the name Rita had set the young adventurers once more upon the track of the abductors of Jane Finn. The question was what to do next. Tuppence hated letting the grass grow under her feet. Tommy was amply employed, and debarred from joining him in the chase, the girl felt at a loose end. She retraced her steps to the entrance hall of the mansions. It was now tenanted by a small lift boy who was polishing brass fittings and whistling the latest air with a good deal of vigor and a reasonable amount of accuracy. He glanced around at Tuppence's entry. There was a certain amount of the gammon element in the girl. At all events, she invariably got on well with small boys. A sympathetic bond seemed instantly to be formed. She reflected that an ally in the enemy's camp, so to speak, was not to be despised. "Well, William," she remarked cheerfully, in the best approved hospital early morning style, "getting a good shine-up?" The boy grinned responsively. "Albert, miss," he corrected. "Albert be it," said Tuppence. She glanced mysteriously round the hall. The effect was purposely a broad one, in case Albert should miss it. She leaned towards the boy and dropped her voice. "I want a word with you, Albert." Albert ceased operations on the fittings and opened his mouth slightly. "Look, do you know what this is?" With a dramatic gesture, she flung back the left side of her coat and exposed a small enameled badge. It was extremely unlikely that Albert would have any knowledge of it. Indeed, it would have been fatal for Tuppence's plans, since the badge in question was the device of a local training corps, originated by the Archdeacon in the early days of the war. Its presence in Tuppence's coat was due to the fact that she had used it for pinning in some flowers a day or so before. But Tuppence had sharp eyes, and had noted the corner of a threepenny detective novel
protruding from Albert's pocket, and the immediate enlargement of his eyes told her that her tactics were good, and that the fish would rise to the bait. "American Detective Force," she hissed. Albert fell for it. "Lord," he murmured ecstatically. Tuppence nodded at him with the air of one who has established a thorough understanding. "Know who I'm after?" she inquired genially. Albert, still round-eyed, demanded breathlessly, "One of the flats?" Tuppence nodded and jerked a thumb up the stairs. "Number 20. Calls herself Vandemeyer." "Vandemeyer, ha-ha." Albert's hand stole to his pocket. "A crook?" he queried eagerly. "A crook? I should say so. Reddy Rita, they call her in the States." "Reddy Rita?" repeated Albert deliriously. "Oh, ain't it just like the pictures?" It was. Tuppence was a great frequenter of the cinema. "Annie always said as how she was a bad lot," continued the boy. "Who's Annie?" inquired Tuppence idly. "Parlor maid. She's leaving today. Many's the time Annie said to me, 'Mark my words, Albert, I wouldn't wonder if the police was to come after her one of these days.' Just like that. But she's a stunner to look at, ain't she?" "She's some peach," allowed Tuppence carelessly. "Finds it useful in her layout, you bet. Has she been wearing any of the emeralds, by the way?" "Emeralds? Them's the greenstones, isn't they?" Tuppence nodded. "That's what we're after her for. You know old man Risedale?" Albert shook his head. "Peter B. Risedale, the oil king. It seems sort of familiar to me. The sparklers belong to him. Finest collection of emeralds in the world. Worth $1 million. "Lummy," came ecstatically from Albert. "Sounds more like the pictures every minute." Tuppence smiled, gratified at the success of her efforts. "We haven't exactly proved it yet, but we're after her, and," she produced a long, drawn-out wink, "I guess she won't get away with the goods this time." Albert uttered another ejaculation indicative of delight. "Mind you, sonny, not a word of this," said Tuppence suddenly. "I guess I oughtn't to have put you the wise, but in the States, we know a real smart lad when we see one." "I'll not breathe a word," protested Albert eagerly. "Ain't there anything I can do? A bit of shadowing, maybe, or such like?" Tuppence affected to consider, then shook her head. "Not at the moment, but I'll bear you in mind, son. What's this about the girl you say is leaving?" "Annie? Regular turn-up, they add. As Annie said, servants is someone nowadays, and to be treated accordingly, and what with her passing the word round, she won't find it so easy to get another." "Won't she?" said Tuppence thoughtfully. "I wonder." An idea was dawning in her brain. She thought a minute or two, then tapped Albert on the shoulder. "See here, son, my brain's got busy. How would it be if you mentioned that you'd got a young cousin, or a friend of yours had, that might suit the place? You get me?" "I'm there," said Albert instantly. "You leave it to me, miss, and I'll fix the whole thing up in 2 ticks. "Some lad," commented Tuppence, with a nod of approval. "You might say that the young woman could come in right away. You let me know, and if it's okay, I'll be round tomorrow at 11 o'clock. "Where am I to let you know to?" "Ritz," replied Tuppence laconically. "Name of Cowley." Albert eyed her enviously. "It must be a good job, this tech business." "It sure is," drawled Tuppence. "Especially when old man Risedale backs the bill. But don't fret, son. If this goes well, you shall come in on the ground floor." With which promise, she took leave of her new ally and walked briskly away from South Audley Mansions, well pleased with her morning's work. But there was no time to be lost. She went straight back to the Ritz and wrote a few brief words to Mr. Carter. Having dispatched this, and Tommy not having yet returned, which didn't surprise her, she started off on a shopping expedition which, with an interval for tea and assorted creamy cakes, occupied her until well after 6 o'clock, and she returned to the hotel jaded but satisfied with her purchases. Starting with a cheap clothing store and passing through one or two second-hand establishments, she had finished the day at a well-known hairdresser's. Now, in the seclusion of her bedroom, she unwrapped that final purchase. 5 minutes later, she smiled contentedly at her reflection in the glass. With an actress's pencil, she had slightly altered the line of her eyebrows, and that, taken in conjunction with the new luxuriant growth of fair hair above, so changed her appearance that she felt confident that even if she came face to face with Whittington, he wouldn't recognize her. She would wear elevators in her shoes, and the cap and apron would be an even more valuable disguise. From hospital experience, she knew only too well that a nurse, out of uniform, is frequently unrecognized by her patients. "Yes," said Tuppence aloud, nodding at the pert reflection in the glass. "You'll do." She then resumed her normal appearance. Dinner was a solitary meal. Tuppence was rather surprised at Tommy's non-return. Julius, too, was absent, and that, to the girl's mind, was more easily explained. His hustling activities were not confined to London, and his abrupt appearances and disappearances were fully accepted by the young adventurers as part of the day's work. It was quite on the cards that Julius P. Hersheimer had left for Constantinople at a moment's notice if he fancied that a clue to his cousin's disappearance was to be found there. The energetic young man had succeeded in making the lives of several Scotland Yard men unbearable to them, and the telephone girls at the Admiralty had learned to know and dread the familiar "hello." He'd spent 3 hours in Paris hustling the prefecture, and had returned from there imbued with the idea, possibly inspired by a weary French official, that the true clue to the mystery was to be found in Ireland. "I dare say he's dashed off there now," thought Tuppence. "All very well, but this is very dull for me. Here I am, bursting with news, and absolutely no one to tell it to. Tommy might have wired or something. I wonder where he is. Anyway, he can't have lost the trail, as they say. That reminds me." And Miss Cowley broke off in her meditations and summoned a small boy. 10 minutes later, the lady was ensconced comfortably on her bed, smoking cigarettes and deep in the perusal of Garnaby Williams, The Boy Detective, which, with other threepenny works of lurid fiction, she had sent out to purchase. She felt, and rightly, that before the strain of attempting further intercourse with Albert, it would be as well to fortify herself with a good supply of local color. The morning brought a note from Mr. Carter. "Dear Miss Tuppence, you have made a splendid start, and I congratulate you. I feel, though, that I should like to point out to you once more the risks you are running, especially if you pursue the course you indicate. Those people are absolutely desperate and incapable of either mercy or pity. I feel that you probably underestimate the danger, and therefore warn you again that I can promise you no protection. You have given us valuable information, and if you choose to withdraw now, no one could blame you. At any rate, think the matter over well before you decide. If, in spite of my warnings, you make up your mind to go through with it, you will find everything arranged. You have lived for 2 years with Miss Dufferin, the parsonage, Lanley, and Mrs. Vandermeer can apply to her for a reference. May I be permitted a word or two of advice? Stick as near to the truth as possible. It minimizes the danger of slips. I suggest that you should represent yourself to be what you are, a former VAD who has chosen domestic service as a profession. There are many such at the present time. That explains away any incongruities of voice or manner which otherwise might awaken suspicion. Whichever way you decide, good luck to you. Your sincere friend, Mr. Carter. Tuppence's spirits rose mercurially. Mr. Carter's warnings passed unheeded. The young lady had far too much confidence in herself to pay any heed to them. With some reluctance, she abandoned the interesting part she had sketched out for herself. Although she had no doubts of her own powers to sustain a role indefinitely, she had too much common sense not to recognize the force of Mr. Carter's arguments. There was still no word or message from Tommy, but the Morning Post brought a somewhat dirty postcard with the words, "It's okay," scrawled upon it. At 10:30, Tuppence surveyed with pride a slightly battered tin trunk containing her new possessions. It was artistically corded. It was with a slight blush that she rang the bell and ordered it to be placed in a taxi. She drove to Paddington and left the box in the cloakroom. She then repaired with a handbag to the fastnesses of the ladies' waiting room. 10 minutes later, a metamorphosed Tuppence walked demurely out of the station and entered a bus. It was a few minutes past 11 when Tuppence again entered the hall of South Audley Mansions. Albert was on the lookout, attending to his duties in a somewhat desultory fashion. He did not immediately recognize Tuppence. When he did, his admiration was unbounded. "Blessed if I'd have known you! That rig out's top hole!" "Glad you like it, Albert," replied Tuppence modestly. "By the way, am I your cousin, or am I not?" "Your voice, too," cried the delighted boy. "It's as English as anything." "No, I said as a friend of mine knew a young gal. Annie wasn't best pleased. She stopped on till today. To oblige, she said, but really, it's so as to put you against the place." "Nice girl," said Tuppence. Albert suspected no irony. "She's style about her and keeps her silver a treat. But, my word, ain't she got a temper? Are you going up now, miss? Step inside the lift. Number 20, did you say?" And he winked. Tuppence quelled him with a stern glance and stepped inside. As she rang the bell of number 20, she was conscious of Albert's eyes slowly descending beneath the level of the floor. A smart young woman opened the door. "I've come about the place," said Tuppence. "It's a rotten place," said the young woman without hesitation. "Regular old cat, always interfering. Accused me of tampering with her letters. Me! The flap was half undone anyway. There's never anything in the waste paper basket. She burns everything. She's a wrong'un, that's what she is. Swell clothes, but no class. Cook knows something about her, but she won't tell. Scared to death of her. And suspicious! She's on to you in a minute if you as much as speak to a fellow. I can tell you..." But what more Annie could tell, Tuppence was never destined to learn, for at that moment a clear voice with a peculiarly steely ring to it called. "Annie!" The smart young woman jumped as if she'd been shot. "Yes, ma'am. Who are you talking to?" "It's a young woman about the situation, ma'am." "Show her in, then, at once." "Yes, ma'am." Tuppence was ushered into a room on the right of the long passage. A woman was standing by the fireplace. She was no longer in her first youth, and the beauty she undeniably possessed was hardened and coarsened. In her youth, she must have been dazzling. Her pale gold hair, owing a slight assistance to art, was coiled low on her neck. Her eyes, of a piercing electric blue, seemed to possess a faculty of boring into the very soul of the person she was looking at. Her exquisite figure was enhanced by a wonderful gown of indigo charmeuse, and yet, despite her swaying grace and the almost ethereal beauty of her face, you felt instinctively the presence of something hard and menacing, a kind of metallic strength that found expression in the tones of her voice and in that gimlet-like quality in her eyes. For the first time, Tuppence felt afraid. She had not feared Whittington, but this woman was different. As if fascinated, she watched the long, cruel line of the red curving mouth, and again she felt that sensation of panic pass over her. Her usual self-confidence deserted her. Vaguely, she felt that deceiving this woman would be very different to deceiving Whittington. Mr. Carter's warning recurred to her mind. Here, indeed, she might expect no mercy. Fighting down that instinct of panic which urged her to turn tail and run without further delay, Tuppence returned the lady's gaze firmly and respectfully. As though that first scrutiny had been satisfactory, Mrs. Vandermeer motioned to a chair. "You can sit down. How did you hear I wanted a house parlor made?" "Through a friend who knows the lift boy here. He thought the place might suit me." Again, that basilisk glance seemed to pierce her through. "You speak like an educated girl." Glibly enough, Tuppence ran through her imaginary career on the lines suggested by Mr. Carter. It seemed to her, as she did so, that the tension of Mrs. Vandermeer's attitude relaxed. "I see," she remarked at length. "Is there anyone I can write to for a reference?" "I lived last with a Miss Dufferin, the parsonage, Lanley. I was with her 2 years." "And then you thought you would get more money by coming to London, I suppose. Well, it doesn't matter to me. I'll give you 50, 60 pounds, whatever you want. You can come in at once?" "Yes, ma'am. Today, if you like. My box is at Paddington." "Go and fetch it in a taxi, then. It's an easy place. I'm out a good deal. By the way, what's your name?"
"Prudence Cooper, ma'am."
"Very well, Prudence. Go away and fetch your box. I shall be out to lunch. The cook will show you where everything is."
"Thank you, ma'am."
Tuppence withdrew. The smart Annie was not in evidence. In the hall below, a magnificent hall porter had relegated Albert to the background. Tuppence didn't even glance at him as she passed meekly out. The adventure had begun, but she felt less elated than she'd done earlier in the morning. It crossed her mind that if the unknown Jane Finn had fallen into the hands of Mrs. Vandermeer, it was likely to have gone hard with her.